Against the worst fuel shortage since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015, Yemen's petroleum company held a press conference to highlight the impact of the Saudi piracy acts in the Red Sea.
In 2021, the Saudi-led coalition prevented entry of fuel needed to meet 95% of the general need for fuel. This shows that the Saudi-led coalition uses fuel as a pressure card amid the ongoing war. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law. The situation is dangerous, especially with the rise of oil prices internationally due to the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Officials say the purpose of the Saudi-led coalition seizure of fuel ships is to raise the price of fuel and spread chaos in the country.
The Saudi-led coalition is continuing its siege intending to raise fuel prices. They believe the rise in fuel prices will force people to go out to the streets and protest. But the Yemenis have proven to the Saudi-led coalition that they know who causes the fuel crisis, and they hold the United Nations responsible for its continued silence.
Besides the war, Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but it has not taken any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts believe Saudi Arabia's recent measures to block Yemen's fuel imports are yet another proof that the Saudi military operation against Yemen is a failure. And they also say the Russia-Ukraine conflict has exposed the international community's double standard on humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gelani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, noise raids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Une volonté de sortir de ce sommet avec une
déclaration. The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as two-thirds of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the two-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
Une forme d'autonomie stratégique.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe. So Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the Concerned Abuja Indigenes said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his six sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, what do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja Concerned Indigenes said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of lead and cadmium in their blood and needed to be hospitalized. They said delaying the medical trip of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat is an infringement on their rights.
The Constitution of Nigeria has given every individual a right to express, right of movement, right to medication, right of everything. Socially. So if right has been given to every individual citizen of the country, why is Sheikh being deprived?
A Kaduna High Court had freed Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat since July 28, 2021. The Islamic cleric and his wife had dragged the Nigerian government to court over its refusal to release their passports to go for medical treatment abroad. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%. Which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the U.S. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government and Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Taiwan has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Taiwan's energy exchange on futures platform, Taiwan's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while there are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Taiwan's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Taiwan's economy. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Islamic Jihad movement held a national conference for women in the Gaza Strip on the occasion of International Women's Day. The conference, titled Woman is the Icon of Resistance, highlighted the role of Palestinian women in fighting the Israeli occupation and their struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip paid a heavy toll during Israel's war on coastal enclave last year. According to human rights groups, the Israeli regime killed 60 women and 22 children in 2021.
We are supporting our women. We called the international, we addressed the international human rights to support our women, asking the international committee to protect the women, to protect the children, to stop the occupation forces against the women in Palestine.
Addressing the conference through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Dr. Ziad Nakhala praised the role of Palestinian women in their struggle against the Israeli regime for more than 7 decades.
Palestinian women will not allow anyone to stop her resistance, consider it to be a red line. Palestinian women share military and political struggle with men. Palestinian women has given a lot for her homeland and abroad.
Conference attendees discussed ways of developing new strategies for women to confront the Israeli regime and its illegal practices, especially against women.
Palestinian women today meeting in Gaza to discuss about the role for women, for Palestinian women and to discuss issues about how to defend the Palestinian in Palestine.
The annual event also tackled ways of bringing international attention to the plight of Palestinian women.
Palestinian women say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of six European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow.
Macron has failed in his mediations because he and Germany have not been able to convince Ukraine to respect the Minsk agreements. If Macron had been able to convince Ukraine of this, then things could have been quite different. France should have been able to achieve this, but the United States obviously didn't want it.
Since 2014, some 14,000 people have been killed in Ukraine. Russia's offensive on February 24th has produced almost 500 civilian deaths and nearly 2 million refugees, according to the United Nations. In recent years, many politicians have argued that the European Union is necessary in order to have peace on the continent. However, forming an EU army, sending arms within Europe, and waging a sanctions war, which is sure to hurt the Russian people, doesn't seem peaceful to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tafai. Russia says the Pentagon is developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories on Ukrainian territory, and that Washington financially has supported a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens such as plague and anthrax. Sounds like a horrible conspiracy theory, but that is not how Russia sees it, leveling those accusations against the U.S. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has felt the need for these biolabs in general, and then remind everyone about how the U.S. has used banned chemical weapons against civilian population in the past. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joins us from Budapest. And writer, radio host, and journalist Don DeBar joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to The Spotlight. Don DeBar, I'm going to first start with you and ask you this question. Moscow accusing Washington of financially supporting a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens like the plague and anthrax. But before your response, let's take a listen to what Vasily Nebenzia, Russia's representative at the UN, has said about this.
We convened a meeting today because as Russia is conducting a special military operation in Ukraine, we discovered a truly shocking fact of emergency cleanup by the Kyiv regime of the traces of a military biological program which is being implemented by Kyiv with its support by the United States Ministry of Defense. Our Ministry of Defense, Russian Ministry of Defense, now has documents which confirm that on the territory of Ukraine there was a network consisting of at least 30 biological laboratories in which very dangerous biological experiments were being conducted, aimed at strengthening the pathogenic qualities of the plague, anthrax, tularemia, cholera, and other lethal diseases using synthetic biology. This work is being done and funded and supervised by the Defense Threat Reduction Agency of the United States and in the interest of the National Center for Medical Intelligence, a unit of the United States Ministry of Defense.
Okay, so there you had it, Don DeBar. What do you think? The U.S. obviously is dismissing this as, I'm not going to use a bad word, but as nonsense. But Russia says obviously what you just heard.
First, just for a little context, Russia called that meeting of the Security Council for Friday because it's one of the requisite steps that in the process of triggering an investigation by the authorities that are provided for under the treaty outlawing those weapons. That's one piece of context. Another, as he mentioned, as Ambassador Nebenzia mentioned, the Defense Department agencies were involved in this research that Jen Psaki, one or two other officials, PR officials of the administration, said were civilian, healthcare-oriented facilities. It was not the CDC. It was not the WHO. It was the U.S. military that was in charge of those sites. And so that's significant. Now, he detailed, for example, 30 sites. We have documents, all of this, which are going to be provided to this investigation. The U.S. Ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, her first reply to this, that lasted 8 minutes or something, she did not make a factual, contest whatsoever, other than a general denial that it was lies, more lies, all of that kind of nonsense, and bad propaganda, fake news, etc. And then when Ambassador Nebenzia focused a little more on both her reply and what some of the U.S. allies on the council had mentioned, providing more detail, She said, I'm not going to dignify this with a response. Now, she left that room, and the press was outside, and she held a press conference. This is exactly what she said, her total comment, after being accused in front of the world of violating the Biological Weapons Treaty and maintaining 30 bioweapons facilities in Ukraine and causing danger to both Europe and the Ukrainian people they're supposedly there to protect. I know that you expect me to respond, she said, but we're not going to give any more airtime to the lies that you're hearing today. It's beneath this council, and there's only one aggressor here, and that's Russia. That was her statement. Mm-hmm. So this followed by one day to conclude testimony under oath in front of a congressional committee by Victoria Nuland, or Victoria Nuland Kagan, as you may prefer, Robert Kagan's ex-spouse or spouse, under oath by a question, direct question by Senator Marco Rubio, does the U.S. have biological weapons in Ukraine? She did not say the magic word, no. She did not say, absolutely not. She said the U.S. has biological facilities there, and she attempted to describe what goes on in there, and they fit the fact pattern of bioweapons, even as she tried to clean it up by characterizing it as something else.
She said, quote, and I'm going to ask you, George Samioli, about this, Ukraine has biological research facilities, which in fact we are now quite concerned that Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we're working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into their hands. Given Victoria Nuland's statement there and what Don DeBar so greatly summed up for us, what are your thoughts about this discovery that Russia has announced at this time and the position that the U.S. has on this, in particular the Pentagon?
Well, I think Don DeBar has summarized it very well. It was very interesting what Victoria Nuland said, because remember, she was asked by Senator Marco Rubio, I think it was something like, does Ukraine have a biological weapons program? I can remember if that was the exact word. And then she started talking about these labs. It was a very strange response because, you know, she could have indeed said, no, of course not. Why then does she immediately start talking about these labs? Because obviously there has to be some sort of a link in her mind between that and a biological weapons program. And then, of course, she said, well, we're very concerned about it falling into Russia's hands. Now, if indeed this is all perfectly innocent and here they were doing some research, you know, purely in the interest of science to counter these terrible infectious diseases, why would be she would be so concerned with its falling into Russia's hands? What is she worried about? The theft of intellectual property? I mean, it was very, very odd. And then, of course, we had the series of denials and convoluted explanations that started pouring out of the U.S. government later that day, and they started then talking about, well, it's about the Soviet-era bioweapons program, and that we're all basically trying to destroy these Soviet-era bioweapons. But the problem there is, well, the Soviet Union came to an end more than 30 years ago. How long does it take to destroy bioweapons? I mean, if all you're required, I would have thought, is to go into some desert somewhere and bury it deep underground. Why is that, you know, that shouldn't have taken 30 years? And apparently this U.S. activity in Ukraine has greatly expanded because it seems that there are now 30 of these labs in Ukraine. And then, of course, there are also of these labs in Georgia. So, you know, again, very, very odd. And then particularly if it is all about these Soviet-era bioweapons, then why again are they so worried about this falling into the hands of Russia? Because presumably Russia would know all about Soviet-era bioweapons. Right. And then, of course, they came up with a lot of innocent explanation. Yeah, it's all about, you know, these infectious diseases. The problem is this. There is, you know, even if you take everything at its most innocent, you have to then think, how would the United States feel if they found out that Russia had 30 biological research laboratories in Mexico? You know, how, and particularly as we've just gone through a two years plus of a global pandemic, in which one very, very plausible theory as to the origin of the virus was a leak from a laboratory. So there are an awful lot of questions, and the United States is not coming up with any very plausible answers.
Well, let's take a step back here, and thank you for that. Obviously, great questions there. But Don DeBar, are we to conclude here, first of all, to come up with a couple of conclusions here, that the U.S. in one way or another, whether it's their Defense Department or Pentagon or whatever other entity, were involved with these laboratories? Do you think then that that's the case? A. B, why would the U.S. be interested in having any type of involvement, whether it's just financing or having more input on this? What uses does this have for the U.S.? Because we're hearing about the plague or anthrax and, you know, these toxins that obviously kill lots of people.
Well, George summarized that, the whole case, really very well, too. And first, it raises, I want to go back just to something I mentioned earlier, because it's a very significant aspect. It's one thing for Jen Psaki or Kirby or one of these characters at a press conference to spew whatever comes out of their mouth. It's another thing, quite another thing, to testify in front of Congress under oath on a direct examination, answering a direct question, an unambiguous question like the one that Senator Rubio asked of Newland. And what it attaches to isn't just the fear of perjury. And they do fear it. They respect that part of the process because it's a political weapon in their own internal political adversaries' hands if they hand it over. But it doesn't just happen in the context of politics here. You have these weapons, if that's what they are or whatever, these materials that they've admitted that are very nasty and very deadly, if people die as a consequence of that, first of all, their existence is most likely a violation of the treaty, and their existence in a war scenario, which Ukraine has been since 2013, 2014, war crime. Anyone that dies, crimes against humanity. Committing perjury in furtherance of that, you're in front of The Hague or, you know, depending on the outcome of this war, perhaps at some sort of war crimes tribunal being administered by Russia and China. They are very cautious about these things, and you see that the answer is the person under direct questioning under oath answers the way she answered, and the PR people answer the way they answered. And that is very significant.
Okay. Well, George Samueli, some might say, you know, come on, how could this be, you know, having the plague or toxins like anthrax or viruses and the U.S. biolabs. But then when we take a look at a brief history check, which is a simple Google search, you come up with some. One of the ones that stands out in some respects are how U.S. forces were accused of using chemical weapons during their assault on Fallujah. That's back in 2003 in Iraq, in which there was evidence showing that the U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus during that time in that city, killing insurgents, as they call them, and civilians at the same time, which obviously causes burns and so forth and so on. So it's U.S. has been involved in using these types of weapons. So then is the conclusion that the U.S. is guilty of being a participant in these laboratories?
Well, that's very interesting because if you recall, after the 9/11 attacks, there was the big sequence, a very mysterious sequence of anthrax attacks, in which suddenly a whole bunch of people, very prominent people in government, received anthrax through the mail. And then eventually this was traced to a U.S. Government laboratory. Now, we came up with, they had an innocent explanation. Yeah, well, you know, there's experiments going on to counteract a particular anthrax attack. So that's all we're really doing. We're just sort of making sure that we have the the antibodies. You know, we have the vaccines against anthrax. That's why we have these laboratories. So that, I think, probably is something of the lines. If you can read, you know, try to figure out what the U.S. is doing, they're essentially figuring that they can stay within the terms of the Biological Weapons Convention by saying, well, what we're really doing is counteracting a possible chemical or biological weapons attack. So that doesn't really violate the Biological Weapons Convention. So in fact, we can go on doing all these dangerous experiments. I mean, it's basically like gain of function, you know, multiplied by 100. In other words, they're making these pathogens more and more lethal. And the justification for it is that, well, hey, supposing, you know, the Russians use these pathogens, we will have the means available to counteract that attack. But the point is that, of course, when you do this, when you create these very dangerous pathogens, then of course you can use them as a weapon yourself. It's not a problem. I mean, you've got the means to deliver these weapons, so you've got them at hand. So the Americans, I think, are, you know, legalistically saying, well, we're staying within the terms of the convention, because there is a vague formulation that, well, as long as it's kind of defensive, you're not kind of in violation of the convention. But essentially, you are creating dangerous pathogens that can indeed be used as weapons.
Well, does this argument stand on the bar for the U.S., there are facts that indicate that aside from these 30 biological labs, the U.S. supposedly is involved in 336 biological laboratories, which it controls in 30 countries around the world. It's very hard to do a fact check on this because it's just tough. But, you know, even if it's just a handful of those, well, 336, I mean, my God, that's a lot. Why does the U.S. feel then in such a scale to have laboratories that contain these types of viruses or banned chemical weapons? I mean, George Samueli said that, you know, just to counter the other side, but in over, 30 countries around the world?
You know, I guess if you're going to say that this is purely defensive, then you could say, well, a good spread around the globe in terms of distribution, in the event you have to deploy some sort of defensive agent, I guess that's what kind of nonsense we're going to hear. Probably that would be Kirby, John Kirby at the Pentagon, his job to try to sell that. You know, obviously, we have precedents. After, most likely before, but certainly after September 11, 2001, the U.S. outsourced all kinds of things that are illegal to do here, torture, waterboarding, you know, all kinds of stuff. To dozens of countries around the world. I don't know exactly why they chose to do, say, 6 countries here instead of 1 or 2, whether it has to do with the capacity of each of them to hide it, whether you need a geographic and a cultural mix for whatever, you know, work they're doing on these people. But, you know, there's 3 other words to consider here, by the way, while we're wondering about the U.S.'s record here, and that's Gulf War Syndrome. Okay, 250,000 American troops out of 697 veterans that were in the Gulf War, they were there for a couple of months, okay? Uncounted numbers of the millions of people in Iraq who were there when whatever happened, and the aftermath, and are still there. Unexplained plague, basically, that killed lots of the 250,000 Americans. Those are the ones we have, you know, a lens on. And we have no idea how many Iraqis, For example, we know in the 90s, attributed to starvation and sanctions, were 400,000 dead Iraqi women and children that Madeleine Albright said was, you know, okay with her. We have no idea how many people died in Iraq of Gulf War syndrome, but Gulf War syndrome exists. And although they blame it on depleted uranium in some quarters, there's been no direct link to that. And it's quite possibly some pathogens involved in this. Sure. So, you know, the U.S., they have a habit of, you know, getting caught with their pants down and saying, well, you know, I'm going to take a shower. There's nothing nefarious here. Right. Even though there's a kindergarten next door where they're, you know, where they're headed.
Okay.
And this stuff, you know, look at what just happened with COVID and how rapidly that spread around the world.
Indeed.
One of these things that some of these geniuses let loose on humanity, you know, you could be looking at a Charlton Heston moment like Omega Man or something faster than you can say Omega Man.
Well, indeed. And that's the depth of the problem here. And alarm bells should be ringing. Because we're looking at what has been reported by Russia, George Samueli. We're looking at this very alarming revelation, in a sense. And, of course, the U.S. saying that, you know, they're afraid that Russia is going to use them. Russia could obviously accuse the U.S. and, in turn, maybe then the Ukrainians' army, perhaps, of doing the same. But what are the chances, based on how things have transpired with the reports coming out, of these chemical entities being used in this war, one form or another? What are the? How do you see the danger of that happening?
It's very dangerous because if you remember, in Syria, Barack Obama declared, well, here's our red line. If the government of Bashar al-Assad uses chemical weapons, then the U.S. will intervene militarily. And of course, lo and behold, the moment Obama said that, we suddenly have, you know, one chemical attack after another, which means that essentially when the U.S. government says this, this becomes a signal for people to use chemical or biological weapons as a false flag operation in order to trigger an American intervention. And we know that that has been the strategy of President Zelensky. I mean, he has no hope of winning this war, and he is clearly not winning the war. But the one thing he's got up his sleeve is this hope that the United States and NATO are going to come in on his behalf. Well, so far, you know, the Biden administration said, no, we're not going to do it.
Right.
However, there's a real question. Suppose there is suddenly a discovery of a biological weapons attack.
Okay.
You know, you have to then wonder whether the Biden administration will stick to its position, no intervention, and might use, because of the hysteria generated by an attack, to get involved militarily. So I think it is very dangerous.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Do apologize for that. Don DeBar, though, writer, radio host, and journalist from New York, spoke to us, gave his insights. Thank you, Don DeBar, and research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli there from Budapest. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitahvayis, goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Children also seem to be able to clear SARS-CoV-2 from their bodies much quicker than adults can, says Smriti Malapati, writer, in an article published under the heading, Kids Show Mysteriously Low Levels of COVID Antibodies. Here's the story. We'll be right back. Children infected with SARS-CoV-2 are less likely than adults to produce antibodies against the virus, despite having similar symptoms and levels of virus in their bodies, according to a small study in Australia. Researchers say the findings add to the growing body of evidence suggesting that children have a more robust initial immune response to COVID-19 and can clear the infection quickly, compared with adults. But because antibodies are likely to be important for guarding against reinfection, the findings raise questions about how well protected children might be against future infections. The study published in JAMA Network Open on March 9th looked at 57 children with a median age of 4 and 51 adults with a median age of 37 who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 between May 10th and October 28, 2020. Participants had mild symptoms such as headaches and fevers or were asymptomatic. The researchers took nose and throat swabs to measure participants' levels of viral RNA and blood samples to check for immunoglobulin G antibodies against the virus. They found that children and adults had similar viral loads, but only 37% of children produced SARS-CoV-2 antibodies compared with 76% of the adults. Previous studies have also seen differing antibody responses in kids compared with adults. An analysis by Donna Farber, an immunologist at Columbia University in New York City, and her colleagues found that adults produce a broader set of antibodies, including more virus-blocking antibodies than children do. Farber says the Australian analysis confirms and extends those findings. Children could be producing fewer antibodies because they have a more robust innate immune response than adults. This is the first line of defense against pathogens and is non-specific. Children could also be better at responding to infections where they enter the body, such as through the throat or nose. This means the body clears the virus quickly and it doesn't hang around to trigger the adaptive response that produces antibodies, says Farber. Other studies, including by Kirsten Mayer, a cellular geneticist at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Hingston, UK, have shown that children mount a stronger and faster response to an infection, and that the innate immune system has an important role in that response. The younger the child, the more likely it is that their innate immune system is driving that response, says Mayer. But Paul Lisiardi, an immunologist at Children's Research Institute in Melbourne and co-author of Australian study, says that when he and his team looked at innate immune cells in a small group of children, they didn't find a stronger response in those who didn't produce antibodies. This is something to look into, he says. The Australian team also measured some participants' levels of immune cells in the blood. They found lower levels of certain classes of antibody-producing memory B cells and memory T cells in children than in adults. This suggests that kids mount less of an adaptive immune response, which is more targeted and generates immune memory, says Betsy Herold, a pediatric infectious disease physician at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. The team worries that if kids have a less vigorous adaptive immune response, that could put them at risk of reinfection. But Harold calls for caution here. We don't have the data yet to make that conclusion. Children might not be as protected from reinfection, but there is still at very low risk of complications from the initial infection, says Mayer. The Australian study also looked only at people who were infected with early variants of SARS-CoV-2, but the results might differ for the more infectious Delta and Omicron variants. In preliminary analyses of people infected
infected with Delta in 2021, Lee Ciardi says he and his team found that most children and adults produced antibodies in response to an infection, which could be because Delta is associated with higher viral loads. The Australian team is now collecting immunological data from people who have been infected with Omicron.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.